Hello, John Dennis here on Tuesday, November the 4th. Today, it's election day in the USA, after the longest and most expensive election campaign in American history, voters face a historic choice.
It's a divided country, and it's going to remain a divided country. I'd like to be able to say otherwise.
Meanwhile, in Britain, with a looming recession, the possibility of a substantial cut in interest rates.
If you give people cheap money, they get addicted to it, and when they don't get an automatic pass on in an interest rate cut, they'll get cross.
And how schools are breaking the rules on admissions, according to an official report. And faith schools are the worst offenders.
He highlighted the fact that there are a handful of schools in Barnet in North London that ask for voluntary contributions on their applications form. Ed Balls kind of presented this as cash for places.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a perusal of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
On the last day of campaigning in the American presidential election, the two candidates crisscrossed the country. The Republican, John McCain, went to seven different cities in seven states. But the final polls are showing the Democrat, Barack Obama, still leading, with more than 50% of the votes likely to go to him. On the eve of the biggest test of his life, Obama announced that his 86-year-old grandmother had died of cancer at her home in Hawaii. He broke off his campaign a week ago to visit her for the last time. He told a campaign rally that she'd been a quiet hero. In Alaska, there was some good news at the last minute for the Republican candidate for vice president, Governor Sarah Palin. The state personnel board cleared her of abuse of power when she sacked a senior law official, the public safety commissioner. Palin had been accused of getting rid of him because he failed to dismiss her former brother-in-law, a state trooper. An earlier investigation by the Alaska Congress did find her guilty. The UN Secretary-General has said he is prepared to go to the Congo to mediate in the renewed civil war. He's appointed a former Nigerian president as his envoy. An aid convoy with medicine and water was escorted by UN troops through the battlefield yesterday to a refugee camp, but workers found the camp completely destroyed. The camp's population of more than 20,000 had disappeared. The British charity Project Merlin said it fears the refugees are now hiding in the forest without food. In Rome, a group of Muslim scholars is meeting the Pope and senior Roman Catholic clerics to discuss better understanding between Christianity and Islam. The conference comes after a report by Islamic scholars warned the survival of the world might be at stake if the two faiths didn't make peace with each other. In Japan, scientists have succeeded in creating clones from the bodies of frozen mice. This is the first time the clones have been made from frozen cells. The scientists say this means they could recreate extinct creatures like mammoths. Well, that story is splashed in today's Daily Mail, cloning from the grave, says the paper. But alongside it is a picture of presidential candidate Barack Obama and his family, who the Mail says are 24 hours away from changing the world. That's the pattern for almost every other paper, with none suggesting that John McCain might be the winner. America's moment of truth, says The Guardian, also adding in a second story that this vote is also about the future of the whole world. The last lap, The Independent calls it, and The Sun says that Obama is in pole position. The Telegraph shows both candidates in campaigning mode, McCain with gritted teeth saying that they are fighting to the last in the race. The Financial Times warns that whoever wins, either man will face the bleakest economic outlook for a generation. It then reports that figures show US manufacturing output has slumped, with October car sales at the lowest in 25 years. On the back pages, two stories dominate. In football, Newcastle continue their renewed vigour under temporary manager Joe Kinnear, beating Villa 2-0. Meanwhile, world champion racing driver Lewis Hamilton has been meeting the press. He tells The Telegraph next year he'll perform even better, but most focus on what he said about all the racist taunts against him. His father, Anthony, told how he almost withdrew his son from the sport. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
It's a momentous day as voters go to the polls across the US. Liberal America holds its breath, while conservative America prays for deliverance. Michael Tomasky, editor of Guardian America, says it's hard to think of an election at which so much was at stake.
Well, when you think back over the whole course of this thing, almost 2 years, and think back to really the fact that Obama was kind of a long shot in February of 2007 when he announced his candidacy, that was a point at which if you'd asked, you know, 100 top pundits in Washington, D.C. who the Democratic nominee was going to be, I would think, you know, 91 or 92 of them would have said it was going to be Hillary Clinton, and that Obama was obviously a very talented guy who was laying the groundwork maybe for a future run, but was not going to be able to beat Clinton. And so here he is all this time later, having beaten Clinton and looking like, unless something really strange happens, he's going to be elected president.
On a day like today, Mike, do you get a sense of America united, or are the divisions all too apparent?
Yeah, it's a divided country, and it's going to remain a divided country. I'd like to be able to say otherwise, but you know, even a smashing Obama victory would give him, say, 54% of the vote. That would be a large victory, 8% in the political climate that we have in the United States now. So you know, that's not exactly a huge mandate. Now, people are watching the Electoral College closely to see, it's expected that he'll go over 300 votes, to see how large that is. But you know, it's certainly the case that this is a divided country. There will be a Democratic majority in Washington, it would appear. But, you know, the divisions in the country are real, and they're over serious things.
A John McCain victory would really be one of the biggest election upsets ever.
I think probably the biggest. I mean, I can't think of another. The one we always point to here in America is 1948, when the Republican Thomas Dewey seemed to be ahead of the incumbent Democrat Harry Truman. And Truman won, and there's the famous photograph of the newspaper headline, Dewey beats Truman, that was wrong, and that was an early edition of a Chicago newspaper that Truman held up, smiling like the Cheshire Cat. But, you know, back in those days, polling was very primitive compared to what we have now, and people didn't really know, you know, we didn't have ways of predicting anything remotely like we have now. So today, with all the polls and all the signs pointing, you know, very strongly to an Obama victory, yeah, I mean, I would think this would be the biggest upset, you know, since all that stuff began, since the television age.
Now, for people hoping to watch the election results unfold on television or at guardian.co.uk, for that matter, which are the states that they should be watching out for tonight?
Pennsylvania, Ohio, Virginia, Colorado. Basically, McCain would have to win all four of those, more or less, to win the election. Obama is ahead in Pennsylvania and seems likely to win in Pennsylvania. He seems likely to win in Virginia. He also seems likely to win in Colorado, though it's not out of the question that McCain might win. Ohio is probably a little bit more up for grabs. But I would say those are the main ones. And you might as well throw Florida in there as well, because Florida also is close, and it's a very large prize, 27 electoral votes. So those would be the main states to watch.
And at what time might we know the result?
Well, I'm going to talk in East Coast times here, since those are the times I know, and people will have to do the calculations. But polls begin to close at 7:30 or 8 o'clock East Coast time, and then 9 o'clock. In many cases, projections, not full results, but projections based on exit polls and preliminary results, will come in very quickly. For example, New York State. The polls close at 9 o'clock. I'm sure they'll come on TV at 9:01 and say Barack Obama is projected to win New York State, because that's going to be a blowout. There will be a lot of states in that category in both directions. McCain's going to win, you know, several states, southern states in particular, and plains states quite handily. So it'll probably be around 11 or midnight East Coast time would be my guess. When we might start to see meaningful results from places like the states I just mentioned.
Michael Tomasky, and there's full coverage of the election today at guardian.co.uk/America. And there's a special edition of Guardian Daily tomorrow focusing exclusively on the election. Also on The Guardian's website, Paul Oerstreicher on Kristallnacht. That's at guardian.co.uk/G2. Also, how to tell if you have a cold, or if it's the flu, or if it's the dreaded man flu, at guardian.co.uk/health. And you can follow Liverpool versus Atletico Madrid and Roma versus Chelsea with our minute-by-minute reports live at guardian.co.uk/football. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee meets tomorrow and it's expected to vote for a big cut in interest rates. Gordon Brown insisted yesterday that people should see the benefits when the Bank of England cuts interest rates. However, David Hodgkinson, the boss of HSBC, who's touring the Gulf States with Gordon Brown, he says his bank might not pass on any cut to its customers, as our economics correspondent Ashley Seeger explains.
Well, I think he thinks that mortgage rates have been underpriced for too long, and that's why we had such a boom in house prices, that interest rates were often at or below even the Bank of England's main lending rate, which caused a problem for the housing market. As we've seen, it's now imploded. So what he's basically saying is that HSBC wants to rebuild its profit margins. If the bank cuts interest rates, it will keep its interest rates where they are. I suspect what he means, though, is he'll keep interest rates where they are for new buyers, because they don't really want any new buyers on their books, but probably they'll pass on cuts for their existing mortgage holders, I would imagine.
What he says won't go down very well with homeowners.
No, not at all. I don't blame them. It's just that if you give people cheap money, they get addicted to it, and when they don't get an automatic pass on in an interest rate cut, they'll get cross. Having said that, a lot of people will be on trackers, which are a guaranteed amount over base. So those, the HSBC will have to cut those. A lot of other borrowers on fixed rates, so they'll be unaffected by the interest rate cut in any case. I would also say that very few people in Britain have mortgages with HSBC. They're not a big part of the mortgage market here, which is probably why they're not in the sort of trouble that HBOS and other lenders are.
Now, the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is meeting tomorrow, the committee that sets interest rates. What's going to be at the forefront of their thinking this week?
They are concerned to head off the deepest, longest, most pronounced recession that Britain has had since the Second World War. They're worried that rightly and belatedly, that the economy is falling off a cliff. We at The Guardian, as you know, have been saying for a long time that the bank should have been cutting rates quicker and deeper than it has done. They're going to be looking at a 1 percentage point cut in interest rates. That would be the biggest cut they've ever made. The city is expecting at least a half. I'm going for a whole percentage point cut for what it's worth, which isn't very much. But that's their worry now, is that interest rates are far too high in Britain for the state of the economy, the state of the credit markets. They need to get the price of money down, and fast.
And we're getting almost daily now evidence of the impending recession. Yesterday, UK manufacturing export orders, we found out they had hit a post 9/11 low, and also the Eurozone seems to be stalling.
Yes, poor old Eurozone, eh? They didn't have the sort of Anglo-Saxon boom and bust of house prices that Britain and America suffered. They didn't have the great boom of the last 10 years, but they've got the bust just as quickly as we have. You almost have to feel sorry for them in a way, but they are going into recession as well. We're going into recession. Manufacturing orders, as you said, the worst since 9/11, largely because British firms sell so much of their product into Europe. And if those economies are in recession, they're not buying British goods.
And we also had details yesterday of the proposed merger between Lloyds, TSB and HBOS. It's bye-bye HBOS.
Yes, the name is going to die, isn't it? Probably, I would suspect it's kind of a tainted name, not so much Bank of Scotland, but Halifax, arguably totally overlent in the housing boom, was very, very proud of its of the amount of mortgage borrowing or lending it was making. But of course, when the market turns south in such a big way as it has done, and house prices falling, I think 15% now year on year, then it doesn't look quite such a clever business model, does it, if you're exposed to falling prices of the product that you've lent on. So yeah, it looks like Halifax name disappearing, Bank of Scotland not such a big household name for most people in Britain, but certainly Halifax was. But these things happen. Bank names die all the time, don't they?
Ashley Seeger. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Coming up, ITV boss Michael Grade has called for a crackdown on swearing on television.
I'm not calling for it to be banned under any circumstances, but I don't think we take enough care.
And what black kids in Britain think about the possibility of Barack Obama becoming president. But first, complaints about the allocation of school places have soared in the last year, according to the annual report from the school's adjudicator. It includes a study ordered by the school's secretary, Ed Balls, into schools' compliance with the government's admissions code. Education editor Polly Curtis has the details.
The school's adjudicator found widespread breaches of a new code which was brought in to tighten up admissions and to try and prevent schools using loopholes or covert selection to kind of select in the easier to teach pupils. So this code was introduced beginning of the year. Ed Balls saw some evidence that it was being on quite a large scale flouted really by schools. That's how he presented it. Then the adjudicator did a big study looking at the majority of faith schools, all of local authority schools, and found widespread and some quite serious problems with schools not complying with the code.
What kind of serious problems did they find?
I should start by saying the biggest problem, which affected about two-thirds of faith schools, was that they weren't properly defining key points on their application forms. So when it said you must live closest to the school, it didn't say whether that was by walking route or as the bird flies. And this seems silly, but when you're a very kind of passionate parent who feels very let down by a system, you'll argue that point until you get your kid into the school. So those definitions are quite serious, and they were very widespread. But the more serious stuff were things like faith schools can use these supplementary information forms, and they were asking what the child's parents do. That would be one way that they might find more middle-class pupils, pupils who have traditionally been easier to teach.
What's been Ed Bowles' reaction to this report from the adjudicator?
He's just welcomed it, said they'll look at it and look at what needs doing. But what's interesting about this is in March, when Ed Balls had this evidence from three local authorities that there were big problems, he highlighted it in a very hard way. He highlighted the fact that there are a handful of schools in Barnet in North London that ask for voluntary contributions on their applications form. The schools always maintained that these were just voluntary, they were for extra faith studies, for security, and that they'd always done it. But Ed Balls kind of presented this as cash for places, that you couldn't get a place in that school without giving the contribution. So he went at it very hard earlier in the year, and it's a different message we're getting from the adjudicator. These are technical breaches. These are schools' naivety and a law being new, so they didn't really know how it worked. It doesn't really tell us any more about how much covert selection's going on.
But on the other hand, covert or not, still very frustrating for parents, as you indicated earlier, when they're trying to get their child into a school but they're being denied because of what might be just a cock-up.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll read the headlines that say up to two-thirds of schools have broken the rules. If your child didn't get a place at that school that they really want to go to, even though they're 2 metres outside the catchment area, you're going to be upset today. And the message from the adjudicator is not good. It's too late to make any difference for people who started school this year. But for next year, these problems should be sorted out.
Polly Curtis. There's too much swearing on television. That's what Michael Grade, ITV's executive chairman, told media journalists yesterday. His call for a crackdown on bad language follows last week's outcry over a prank phone call to the actor Andrew Sachs, which led to the resignation of the controller of BBC Radio 2, Leslie Douglas, and her star signing, Russell Brand, and the suspension of the BBC's highest paid entertainer, Jonathan Ross. Matt Wells presents our Media Talk podcast. He told me what Michael Grade said.
Well, he was speaking at a long-arranged lunch briefing with the Broadcasting Press Guild. Now, this is a group of journalists who write about the media, and perhaps inevitably he was asked about the Ross Brand fiasco, and in particular he was asked about what long-term effect it would have on television. Now, he agreed with the comments made by the BBC Director-General Mark Thompson at the weekend that the salaries of top stars like Jonathan Ross would be likely to come down, although he thought that was happening anyway. But he went on to say that he thought there ought to be more consideration given to the use of bad language on television.
I do think the prevalence of bad language, the F word, etc., on TV is a little unrestrained. I'm not calling for it to be banned under any circumstances, but I don't think we take enough care over the use of the F word and similar words, if there are similar words. I remember, I'm beginning to sound like an old so-and-so now, but you know, it used to be that you had to get very, very senior sign-off to be able to use that word in a show without bleeping it. I'm not sure what the rules are these days. Clearly, not enough consideration is given to a very large section of the audience who perhaps don't want to hear that word or the, such words. You therefore have to know why you're using it and give it a little bit of extra consideration. Seems to me rather indiscriminate now.
Matt, there's been some criticism of the BBC's response to Manuel Gate last week. Did Mr. Grade have any view on that?
Yeah, he did actually, and his view is worth taking into account because before taking up his current position at ITV, he was chairman of the BBC Board of Governors. This is the body that preceded the BBC Trust, so he knows one or two things about this. But rather going against the grain, I thought, Mr. Grade expressed the view that the BBC's response had been remarkably swift.
I've never seen the BBC act so quickly. I know that there was criticism of the BBC for acting slowly. I think they were slow to put a spokesman up when the story first emerged, but I mean that's a pretty minor criticism. They acted very, very quickly. I thought it showed without, beyond peradventure, that having the sovereign body of the BBC, the Trust, inside the organisation, able to call, send for the Director General ensure that the right action was taken, showed that the structure of the Trust actually works extremely well. So, you know, full marks all round. I thought, you know, it was sod's law that it was half term and, you know, Mark was away. I mean, those things happen. But once they realised what had happened, I thought they acted absolutely correctly. The result was absolutely spot on. I thought it was beyond criticism.
I should say here that Mr. Grade helped set up the BBC Trust, so perhaps he would say that. But he does have a point, in fact, in that Ofcom is a post-facto regulator. Now, it couldn't and would not have called the Director-General, Mark Thompson, back from holiday in Sicily. It would have dragged on, the whole thing would have dragged on for much longer, and a bad situation for the BBC could have been infinitely worse.
And what about the call yesterday from the Conservative Party leader David Cameron for BBC executive salaries to be curbed?
Well, this bandwagon is heaving on its axles now, isn't it? The truth is that David Cameron would have little power over the BBC as Prime Minister and would be unlikely to be able to change the BBC executive's salary structure even if he wanted to.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, tens of thousands of refugees have been pouring in and out of the eastern provincial capital Goma. They're fleeing robbery, rape or murder at the hands of Congolese troops that are supposed to be defending them from a rebel army of ethnic Tutsis led by the warlord Laurent Nkunda. The rebels say they're defending themselves against ethnic Hutus from neighbouring Rwanda. I spoke to Oxfam aid worker Rebecca Wynn yesterday. She's with refugees across the border in Rwanda. Our apologies for the poor sound quality of this interview.
The refugee situation in terms of numbers is actually sort of very difficult to establish. But I can talk to you about Kabati Camp, which is where I was today. Now, Kabati Camp is 4 kilometres north of Goma. And it's basically really on the front line of the war. So the people there are incredibly vulnerable. If violence breaks out again, they are the ones that will be affected and will have to move again. People have to move sort of time and time again. So I was talking to displaced people who, this is the fourth time they've fled. There's about 7,000 people in the camps, but most of them have arrived there in the last just month or so, and many more over recent days. The UNHCR told me that they've registered 1,000 people today.
How difficult is it for organisations such as Oxfam to distribute food and water and medicine and offer shelter to these people?
We've been working in Goma, and we're helping 65,000 people in Goma at the moment. We're in the camps and we're providing clean water and sanitation, and that's kept going throughout the fighting. You know, the water the water tanks, the water taps, everything is still in good working order, which we're really pleased about. Just yesterday, in Kapyabonga, which is north of Rushuru, which is really the epicenter of the fighting at the moment, we're tracking water to people. They're not people who are in camps, because in Congo, not everybody flees to camps. For example, some people live with families in the community. Some people shelter in public buildings, such as schools. So we're just trying to get water to people who are in need, not necessarily people who are in the camps.
Rebecca Wynne from Oxfam. The possibility of a black man being elected to the most powerful office in the world will have a profound effect on race equality around the world. What does the prospect of victory by Barack Obama mean to young black people in Britain? Martin Wainwright went to Leeds to find out.
It means quite a lot, actually, because in today's modern society, it's become a multicultural society, which allows everybody to have an opportunity, and not just one race to be in power, but it allows everybody from any nationality, any background, to have an opportunity to rule America, so speaking. So I think it's good.
I think it's really inspirational, like a black man like him, like being president, yeah, that's really good. It makes us like achieve what we want to achieve in life, like in the future, like I could be whatever I want to be, like, and he's just inspired me to know that, yeah. He would make a difference, Barack Obama, when he becomes president, or if he becomes president.
For as long as I know, it's mainly be like white people president, so if for a change, yeah, it's good to have a black president.
Do you think the fact that it's America is good? Because on the whole, people may not particularly like America, but we tend to copy America. America seems to lead the way.
Yeah, I like America, so yeah, we'll end up copying him.
How would you feel if he didn't win tomorrow? I mean, he's done very well, but would it be disappointing?
I would be disappointed, but even if he did lose, he got so far, so if I were him, I'd be proud of how far we got.
Right, I've got somebody here who's not quite so young. I'm not going to ask him how old he is. But Brainerd Bremer in Leeds has devoted his life to trying to get young black kids, and maybe especially boys, to raise their sights, to look for inspiring role models, and to do well. It's something he did himself. He was plucked from, how shall I put it, Bremer, a village in Ghana, and he's now a senior figure in Leeds in education circles. Bremer, can I ask you, a lot of people are saying Barack Obama, you know, maybe the most powerful man in the world shortly, and Lewis Hamilton has brilliantly won the Formula One championship. Do you think that young black boys, particularly young men, will draw inspiration from this?
Well, I sincerely hope so. It has actually demonstrated very, very clearly that there are no limitations to which young people can actually achieve, provided you are prepared to work at it. The best thing that could happen, not just to black people, not to America, if Barack Obama is able to get into the White House, that would be the best thing that the world would have seen. Yeah.
Good. And Lewis Hamilton, he's obviously, it's not the same as being the president of the United States, but his whole story seems to be quite inspirational in a way, and his father seems to have been a good role model for him.
There's no doubt about that. The underachievement of young people, as I've said, you know, over three generations, has been the lack of role models. There's no one better than Lewis Hamilton coming up to demonstrate that, especially in a sport which is exactly not a cheap sport to be in, but he has clearly demonstrated that you can achieve anything, provided you set your eyes to that, you set your goals and work towards them. And I think that's what he did.
Martin Wainwright reporting. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth, Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.